During this time, it's more important than ever to support our friends and neighbors in the restaurant industry. Restaurant Workers Community Foundation has set up a national COVID-19 crisis relief fund. The money they raise will provide direct relief to individual restaurant workers, support other nonprofits serving restaurant workers in crisis, and offer zero-interest loans for restaurants to get back up and running. Visit restaurantworkerscf.org to donate today. And if you need a little extra motivation, you can DM your $20 donation to RWCF's co-founder, John DeBerry, on Twitter, and he'll give you directions for making a signature quarantine cocktail. Donate now at restaurantworkerscf.org.
Hey everyone, this is Sari Kamen. I'm the Public Programs Manager at MOFAD. I am conducting an online video interview right now with Alicia Kennedy. She's a journalist based out of Puerto Rico. She's covering the restaurant industry and food from the perspective of living in Puerto Rico, but still talking about what's happening on the ground in the United States. So Alicia, hi. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So why don't you, just tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're working on?
Sure. So I'm usually a food writer, a food and drinks writer. And right now I'm covering the COVID pandemic, trying to kind of center food service workers and their needs and their, the labor rights that have maybe been denied to them in the past, and also how we can maybe recover from this in a more equitable fashion. I wrote a piece for Plate magazine that was published yesterday where I got mostly anonymous stories of how different restaurant workers are dealing with the crisis, like how their bosses are treating it, whether seriously or not, whether they're getting paid time off or whether they've been laid off to be put on unemployment, whether their bosses are simply ignoring what's going on. And I have a piece going out for Thrillist, I believe today, where I talk to some small business owners about how their pivots are working for them, how their business pivots are working, like, selling gift cards, selling merchandise, and what they're using that money for, and, also how delivery is working for people who don't usually do delivery. Trying to figure out what kind of business models are actually functioning best in the crisis. And I also am working on a longer lead piece for Refinery 29 about labor rights in the restaurant world, kind of inspired by both the Tartine union fight in San Francisco and also now with this crisis and how so many bar and restaurant owners are basically ignoring their responsibility to their employees completely. Putting everyone on unemployment is, of course, a valid response, but also how can we make it so that in the future these workers are not kind of left out to dry, especially tipped workers or part-time workers in this industry who are not going to get their full unemployment benefits. Just kind of like working on labor stuff around this, which is interesting because I actually wanted to get more into doing labor stuff this year and I didn't expect it to be like under the circumstances of like a pandemic, but we take what we can.
So I'd love to hear a little bit more about each of those pieces and kind of like what you are learning, but before we do that, can you just tell us a little bit about like what your life is like right now, like what's happening on the ground in Puerto Rico?
So we only have 8 confirmed cases here on the island right now, but the government here has been taking a lot more precautions than it seems a lot of city governments in the United States have. Everything was basically shut down as of Sunday night. And in the time since, it's been getting a little bit more intense about making sure people are staying in their homes. Like for the first few days of this, there were still a lot of tourist groups walking around. They weren't really social distancing at all. These were generally Americans. It was a little scary and unnerving. Even though I have a dog who has to go out, and even though, for the most part, because you, for the most part, Puerto Ricans are taking it seriously, and there is social distancing, and, you know, there's still coffee shops open. So it's like, you know, you want to try and support those places staying open and like maintain some sense of normalcy. But at the same time, it's getting a lot more intense because of these people who weren't following any rules. And now the cops are out there like being like, get in your house, get in your house. like this morning, walking my dog. We got sent home because, I don't know, the cops just wanted us to go home. And it's like, you know, the dog still needs to go out. So, but now I'm like, oh, every time I go outside, now the cop is going to send me inside, which, yeah, it's no way to live. But I mean, for me, I'm a freelancer. So my life is mostly unchanged. You know, I'm like, I'm busier now, because I'm doing reporting on this, and, you know, I'm cooking worse because I'm so busy. So, you know, it's like, I'm not as good as a cook as I usually am, but I'm a busier writer. So that's something, I don't know.
But like, I mean, what are the expectations as far as like going outside? Because I mean, obviously your dog has to get walked, and like, I mean, I would think that there's some understanding that that's like, there's certain rituals that can't stop.
Yeah. And I mean, and from what I've seen in terms of like the protocols that have been going out, like all these little graphs about like what you can do, what you can't do, what, and going for a walk is fine, you know, and, you know, maintaining distance from other people is fine. So I think they're being a bit overly, I don't know, they're just being cops, you know? So like, they're just, they're being, you know, overly strict about this, I think. But, you know, at the same time, I would be really nervous if I were still living in New York right now. I don't know how I would have acted last week. I don't know, like, what the information is like that people are getting. I mean, obviously I'm online all the time. So it's like, I've seen what's happened to Italy, like as of last week. And, you know, I've seen what's happened to other European countries and the measures they're taking and how seriously they're taking this. And so I'm nervous for my family on Long Island, where there's, you know, the cases are steadily increasing. But Cuomo has set up some drive-through testing centers, but no one I know has any symptoms so far, knock on wood. But I mean, the hardest part of it for me definitely is like being away from my family right now. But at least I know that I'm in a place that's kind of taking it seriously. So
yeah. Why do you think there's just such a disparity in the way that the Puerto Rican authority is handling the measures versus the way that, you know, Americans in large cities where the numbers are high, where we don't have like shelter
right
at this point?
I mean, the government here is not good, and we're still under, you know, the United States as the federal government, as a colony of the United States. But there are all sorts of hypotheses around why they're actually taking it seriously. But I do think, you know, they let in cruise ships where there were infected patients. And so that's how we have like a few of the cases of infected people. And it's true that just having gone through a recent crisis and with Hurricane Maria makes people, I think, a bit more conscious of how things can go really poorly, really quickly. There's also more people here maybe paying attention to the news in Europe versus in the United States.
Sorry, I also didn't mean to imply that Puerto Ricans weren't Americans. I just meant
No. I mean, I Americans in a very second class fashion, yeah. A columnist. But I think all these factors kind of combined to make it a more serious circumstance. But at the same time, I mean, the government response in terms of like whether employers need to pay for paid time off, or like what the tax situation is going to be for different businesses. Like, these things aren't being taken care of really. And the unemployment here is so low. I think it maxes out at maybe 190 a week. These things are, we're still in a bad situation in terms of like whether people are actually going to be taken care of. But at the same time, the spread is being hopefully staunched by these like measures now. So is anyone dealing with this properly? South Korea? And that's it. So.
What are some of the the big challenges you're facing as a reporter right now, because things are moving so fast and so quickly. Like, how are you managing just keeping up with the news cycle in terms of like writing as fast as you possibly could and like things just changing overnight?
Right. It's really difficult. But the thing is that I think that's why I'm focusing on kind of more evergreen subjects around this, which is, you know, labor rights, the precarity of restaurant work, the low wages that are, you know, I mean, someone said it to me, a waiter said to me for my piece for Plate, the food media focuses on the restaurants that are doing well, on the high profile chefs, on the people who are making a lot of money. And like, the fact is that most people who work in restaurants are doing not enough money to live, to survive. They're piecing together different opportunities, different jobs in order to make a living. And that one, that makes it more difficult for them to get unemployment. It makes it much more difficult for them to get unemployment that's going to cover their expenses. And so the challenge here, it can be that like all these numbers are changing overnight and like there's all these different restaurant groups that are advocating for different measures from the government, and those things change. But what doesn't change is that this labor force has already been overlooked, and now people are actually paying attention to food service, which is a positive thing, but I don't know if we're paying attention to it in the right ways. So just trying to kind of, you know, get the evergreen aspect of this and put it into context for right now, while people are paying attention to it, is I think the only way I can deal with it, especially because I'm, you know, I'm not on staff somewhere. I don't have the luxury of like taking a lot of time to do like more thorough reporting on these things. So, I mean, for me, it's actually like a good way of getting into these issues that I've wanted to get into. I wish it were under better circumstances, but like while people have all their eyes on restaurant labor and hospitality workers, I think it's a good opportunity to ground the conversation, not in like David Chang or, you know, Danny Meyer, but to ground the conversation in what the lives are like already and what they can be in the future for the people who actually cook the food, serve the food, make the drinks, et cetera. Yeah. So that's what I'm focused on.
Yeah, I mean, what are kind of like the main sort of points that you're trying to highlight as far as ways that the restaurant industry has failed their workers?
I mean, they failed their workers in like so many ways. I've talked to, for this Thrillist piece I that should go up today, you know, I talked to a couple of people who are actually succeeding right now, despite everything. This bar in the East Village, Lois, where I actually used to work, they do a no tipping model, and hospitality is included. So because of that, they don't rely on the customers to pay their employees, you know, so they're used to having a big payout for payroll every single week. And they also have all of their employees on a set schedule. Whereas like a lot of these places, you know, it's week to week, whether you know what days you're working, et cetera, how many hours you're gonna get. So because of that model where people already know what they're getting paid, the business is used to holding on to a lot of money for payroll, they're actually able to guarantee paid time off for 6 weeks to all of their staff. And another restaurant that's doing well is Otto in Seattle, where chef owner Eric Rivera kind of already has a mishmash of things going on in his restaurant all the time. You know, they do classes, they do tastings, they do tasting menus, they do brunch. So it's like, you know, it's not just a place that you go to do the 20 course tasting menu with wine pairings and then never go back to again. Like maybe you go there to have like a funny pop-up that's themed, or you go there to have brunch like on a normal weekend. And because of that kind of like creative model, he's been able to, you know, turn to, you know, delivering pantry ingredients, doing pop-ups where people are, you know, you can buy a $9 bowl of food, or, you know, for more well-off clients, like they can spend $95 for a few meals and a bottle of wine. And so like having that dexterity has worked for him, and he's been able to move some of his employees from part-time to full-time during a pandemic when most restaurants are laying people off.
What are they doing?
And so he's still on target to start providing health insurance for employees in a couple of months. So basically like the owners who have already had this model and this ethos of like we're creative and we care about our employees have done really well. I mean, that's, of course, a lot of places are still struggling because these are incredible circumstances. And it doesn't mean that they don't care about their employees or have a good business model. But at the same time, I think this is really showing the cracks in what is the traditional restaurant model, where the customer is basically responsible for how much all these employees make. There are no health benefits. There's no paid time off. There's not a lot of transparency. There's no human resources departments where, you know, people can advocate for themselves. There's no unions where people can advocate for themselves. So I think that these cracks are showing where a lot of work needs to be done in the restaurant industry to make it actually a viable workplace. I mean, we're in a place in the economy and in the culture where people are career bartenders, are career cooks, are career servers, and that should be paid as such. It should be paid like as though these people have an expertise, because they do. And instead we treat it as low wage work that gets, you know, tipped based on whoever walks in and what kind of day they're having. And that's what has to stop. I mean, is it going to make eating out like more of a special occasion in most cases? Probably. But I'm hoping, like, my hope is that in writing these pieces, like, to kind of show this disparity and these problems. And then in the Refinery 29 piece that I'm reporting, like, find what are the solutions to this? Like, how do you make this workforce that is clearly so huge and so, like, should be powerful. How do you actually make them have a voice in their own day-to-day lives?
Yeah. I mean, do you think that the responsibility should all be on the employers, or do you think it makes sense for the government to get involved at this point, like going forward in a future model?
At this point, for sure, the government needs to get involved in terms of like rent freezes, bill freezes, utility freezes, tax freezes for businesses and sales tax. And also like for me personally, like Medicare for all should be, you know, the employer shouldn't have to pay for healthcare for their employees. That's too big a burden on restaurants where margins are too thin. But also, like, why does that mean that restaurant employees, which, you know, provide so much luxury to people, don't get health insurance? That doesn't make any sense. So, you know, there are a lot of different governmental and regulatory ways in which this situation can change and work better for people. But I don't see them happening under the current rule. And so I think it requires a real restructuring of how restaurants work when we all come back from this.
I'm curious, the reporting that you did for your plate story, why so many of the servers that you spoke to chose to remain anonymous when these issues are so kind of like universal within the industry? You'd think that like there would be, you know, not so much fear about speaking out about things that, so, you know, are so critical in this moment.
They're so critical and they're so important and they are so universal, basically. But at the same time, people are afraid, you know, that they're not going to be able to get a job again. If they're going to be labeled a problem employee, and then that's it, they're out. And this is what they know, this is what they do. And I think there is a lot of fear of retribution because of that lack of power that these workers have. Like, they, you know, they're not getting paid real sustainable wages. They don't have healthcare, they don't have a union, they don't have human resources in most cases, they don't have anyone to go to talk about these things. And so in opening up this anonymous kind of space where people can at least tell their stories, it seems, one, like cathartic, but it also seems kind of the only way to really report on these things. I mean, I think it can be challenging, especially like a lot of newspapers have policies around off the record or anonymous sources and that sort of thing. But at the same time, like, who does that favor? That favors the people who have the power and have the money. And so I'm really appreciative of having spaces where I can give a voice to people who are just afraid to speak out because they're going to lose their livelihoods, their families will lose their livelihoods. And it's just really important. And obviously the more the system changes, the more that we make restaurant work and bar work equitable for workers, the more that'll change, the more workers will actually be less afraid to come forward and say, hey, you know, I mean, look at what happened with, I mean, Harvey Weinstein, you know, look at me, you know, these, and Mario Batali, to speak about our industry, like, it didn't come out until it was safe to come out.
It's going to be more impactful if people feel more empowered and start using their names and their voices.
I think it would be, but at the same time, I mean, I can't make that decision for them, and they need to make that decision. And so I think it will, if we can create a groundswell of people talking about these issues, the way that the Me Too movement created such a significant groundswell of voices that couldn't be ignored. It's another similar situation of like, we have to talk about the abuse here, and not all of this abuse is physical, tangible, verbal, even. It is just in terms of the structures that manage people's everyday lives and control them. And so I think that if we can create spaces where people feel comfortable and heard and know that they are important, that the conversation can change. And then maybe people will feel more comfortable having their names out there. But I mean, right now it's scary. It's a scary situation. People don't want to have us come out of this into the same restaurant landscape and where they still don't have the rights or any hope of real, like equitable working conditions, and have been labeled someone who is willing to go talk to journalists and that sort of thing. I mean, I already had one person tell me, she's like, I've gotten in trouble before for talking to a journalist, so I don't want to do it. And that's understandable. But we need to create conditions where people aren't afraid to speak out about injustice. So.
Yeah. I know you are busy writing, so I don't know how much time you have to read the food media that's out there right now, but like from your perspective, how do you think things should shift, or if they should shift in terms of like where the focus is at right now?
I mean, I've seen some really good, Eater has been doing great stuff. But at the same time, there's a huge focus on restaurant chefs, on, you know, on the people on top, on the people that maybe the names are known and that sort of thing. And I think that the Washington Post also has done good stuff in terms of like centering different voices. But I think right now the people who are really suffering are the people who've lost all of their wages, who don't know when unemployment is going to come, who don't know how they're going to make rent on April 1st. You know, I'm not going to shed a tear for Danny Meyer, who is worth hundreds of millions of dollars and just laid off 2,000 lower wage workers. It's just not gonna happen. So we have to, in the food media, make sure we're centering the people who need advocacy right now. And I know that that's a tricky word in our business, but I mean, advocacy is probably the wrong word. It's just the people who need justice right now, who've lost everything and can't just go out and get another job or can't get an endorsement deal from Sweetgreen. You know, it's the people who need the help right now. So,
you live in Puerto Rico, so you know you're not doing a lot of like face to face interviews anyway, probably with chefs that are over in the United States. But what are the strategies that you've been using to try and like connect with people as quickly as possible, since you know there is like social distancing and you know all the different barriers at this point?
Right. Well, luckily I have a pretty decent social media network, and also know a lot of people in the industry. So I've been doing one thing I started after I did the plate piece was a Google survey for food service workers to fill out, which I'm basically just using as a resource to both kind of take the temperature of where people are and like what kinds of things are happening, and also to collect data, and also to research this piece for Refinery 29. And so like I'm gathering a lot of information from a lot of different people and like just hopefully getting a lot of geographic diversity in there and like diversity around like the positions people have in restaurants. And then I'm going to follow up and do like phone interviews so that it can, and actually have like some contact with people. Just like Instagram, trying to pay attention. People have been coming to me a lot via DM or via email because I put this out there and just been like, yeah, I just want to share my story about this, or I want to share my husband's story, and that sort of thing. And so that's been good. It's been good to be, and I think being able to do anonymous sourcing again, like, helps people feel like they can trust what's going to happen, because they don't have to necessarily put their lives on the line for it. So yeah, just kind of like, it's not emerged out of nowhere, but this week has been a big one. So, just trying to organize my information as much as possible. And yeah, the Google form has helped with that. And luckily a lot of people I know shared it. A lot of people in the industry shared it. So, just collecting a lot of information about what people need and what people are getting right now.
Yeah. For people watching this who want to support workers that have been laid off and businesses, what are some really meaningful ways that we can help?
I think the most meaningful way at this point, I mean, of course, if you have a favorite restaurant or a bar that you go to all the time and they have a specific, you know, tip jar or gift card or, you know, buy merchandise, et cetera, like, do that if you have the money. But I think a part of this right now is that we're all kind of scared about what the economy is going to look like soon. And, you know, so many workers are being laid off in different fields that it can feel a bit precarious for everybody financially. So I think the best way is to be talking to your representatives and tell them that, you know, what you need, I mean, for whatever industry you work in, and also just like, you know, hey, what are we doing for small business? What are we doing for workers who've been laid off in industries where they can't go to work anymore? I think that that's the most significant thing that needs to be done, is just to like make sure they know that people are watching and that people won't relent until some action has been taken that really means something to the majority of people. Otherwise, we come back to a world of McDonald's and Subway. So,
yeah. Any kind of like predictions of what we're going to look like on the other side of this? Or, I mean, do you feel optimistic in any way that, you know, as horrible as these circumstances are, they are highlighting, you know, so many different issues that need to be attended to and changed?
I mean, that's the only optimism we can have right now, I think, is that all these broken systems are showing their cracks so clear, like, just the cracks are enormous, or just, you know, that it's gutting an entire industry. So yeah, I think that we can come back and fix that. And I hope just in the meantime, we can make sure that everyone knows that they're not alone, and that we're, you know, we're all in a similar, if not the same boat. And what, you know, we need to do whatever we can to like make this easier.
Yeah. Any other kind of like last takeaways from the reporting that you've been doing that you feel like you really want to just share at this point that, you know, we're not necessarily seeing in the headlines?
I mean, just that unemployment is not as cut and dried as you think it is, especially in the restaurant industry. So all these people who are just being like, see ya to tons of employees and saying go on unemployment, you know, the system is strained. It's taking a long time to even apply for or claim benefits. And people, especially in the restaurant industry, are not going to necessarily be making the same amount of money that they were making when they were working off of the system. And so it's totally inadequate. And so I think people just need to be mindful of that, that like when they see people saying, oh, we laid everyone off to put them on unemployment, and like, that's not enough. Like there needs to be more effort there. And to support the small businesses who are being transparent about the efforts that they're doing, to make sure that the workers who have created their business are continuing to, you know, survive through this safely.
Alicia, how can we keep up with your work? Where can we find you on social?
Oh, well, Alicia Kennedy on Twitter, tweeting too much. And then Alicia D. Kennedy on Instagram, where I'm a bit more subdued. So like, those are the things.
Depending on what Alicia, a version of Alicia you want.
Yeah, if you want like the full thing, Twitter, if you want like the much prettier version, it's Instagram. And then Alicia Dash Kennedy.
Alicia Unleashed.
Yeah, exactly. .com is my website. So yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Alicia. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.